Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's September 18th, 2016. Welcome to episode 137 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now. And my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting. And I guess if we had one more three in that episode number, we'd be leet or something like that. But we're going to have to wait a long time for that. Anyway, I'm here with the cast of regular irregulars. I'm going to start by throwing it over to Carrington. It's been a while since you and I have been on the show together, and it is a pleasure. And also, I understand that maybe you were out in the woods and we're lucky to have you back. So
yes, I did camping. There was much camping. Canadians, summer, we like cottages and we like camping. Well, some of us like camping. I like it. Most of my friends don't. But yes, I was way up in Algonquin Park for a while and it was pretty cool. Actually, it was pretty hot.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad you had fun. Anyway, and I'm glad that you're back to talk to us about retroness. Speaking of retroness, the king of retroness, Paul Hagstrom. I've nominated you king, Paul.
Long may he reign.
That's right.
Thank you. Yeah.
How are you, sir?
I'm pretty good. So I live an academic life, and the school year has begun, and it's killing me. But other than that, everything's good.
Well. So you teach classes? Is that what it is, or what's your role?
Yeah, I'm one of those university professor types.
So, yeah, wonderful.
Teach so I have classes.
Got to ask, do your students appreciate you?
Oh, hard to say.
Let's look online, shall we?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
I was going to say,
rate my
to
professor.
My face, they do. But
Maybe another time. So, before I get myself in trouble, I better switch over to Jack in Sweden. Jack is our official Scandinavian reporter for all things retro computing. Jack? How does it go, sir?
It's going well. The most retro stuff that I've been doing lately is cleaning out my garage, in which I find all kinds of old stuff that is not necessarily computer-related. Some of it is, but I feel very retro in the sense that I've been digging through dust and mouse poop and moldy old boxes.
Isn't it crazy how those little guys get into that stuff? And
it's amazing. We had boxes that were taped shut and had an opening at the top where the paper was folded over, and the box on the outside looked entirely fine. But a little mouse had decided to crawl in through that top, in and out, and everything inside was pretty infected with unsavory mousiness.
I'm sorry to hear that. I know that people have had their retro computers infected in such way, and it can actually wreak havoc on the printed circuit boards and such. So, yeah.
I did actually pull out my box containing my old broken Atari Jaguar and some other stuff, and that seemed to be untouched by the hand of mouse. So,
good.
Happy
good.
About that. I re-taped it up with extra tape just to make sure this time
hermetically
it can rest
sealed.
Easy for the next 15 years. It's not going to be ruined.
Very good. All right. I myself am doing pretty good, having fun. I'm ready for fall. This has been an awfully hot summer here in Portland. And, it's very pretty, and we look forward all year to the blue skies. But I have to admit, I'm looking forward to some slightly cooler temperatures. Things have been a little roasty. So, yay for some rain, and it keeps things green. And so there you go. I guess, well, before we get into the host topic, I'm going to mention one piece of listener feedback. When we were talking about Jumpman and level editing with Omnivore, we mentioned Kevin Savitz, whose name I have now officially mentioned for this episode, so you guys can breathe easy. But we didn't mention Rob McMullen. So, Rob, sorry about that, and thanks, Wade, for catching that. We appreciate it. You know, want to make sure that people get their proper kudos and that sort of thing for their contributions to the fun that we all have.
Mm-hmm. Kudos, too, to Rob's podcast, Player Missile, which I like quite a bit.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Yeah. He gave a great presentation at Kansas Fest, actually, about the levels that they had added and about Omnivore and stuff. It was one of the better ones. I really liked it.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it was Atari.
And I'm I'm glad he did that because I love the name Chicken Missile and I have to make a video game called Chicken Missile.
Right.
But what were you going to say, Paul?
Oh, just that the distribution of labor, I think, between Kevin and Rob was that Rob wrote the program and Kevin tested it and made levels. So I think Rob may have also made levels, but Rob is the one who's really primarily, like, he wrote the thing. So,
yeah. Excellent.
It'd be good if he got mentioned. Yeah.
And I've said that in the intervening time, I've actually downloaded the latest version, played with it, and played with doing some level editing. And it's actually super cool, and it's nice because you can just, like, you say, I want to make a new level, and you save it, and it fires it up in the Atari emulator, and boom, there it is. It's actually a very sort of nice, quick REPL there. So I approve.
Thumbs
Hooray.
Up.
Hooray! All right.
I wonder at what point they will turn Jumpman for the Apple into something worth playing. Because it's so bad on the Apple and it's so good on the Atari, alas.
The package looks nice.
But there's that.
I don't think anything will ever beat the game that I love most on the Apple, which was Castle Wolfenstein. That game was just hilarious fun. You guys know that game, right?
Oh, yeah.
Super famous. Yeah.
I find it overrated.
Really?
Yep, I am the dissenting opinion of that. Mostly because it is nigh unplayable with all the controls available, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think people misremember how hard it is to play.
Oh, it wasn't easy.
It's because it's designed to be used with paddles. It's designed to be used with both paddles, one in each hand, moving the paddles and pressing the buttons because you're like, press the button to move, press the other. Like, it's just... it's terrible.
And it's so easy to hit the wall.
It was so early. I think they were still developing how should one move in a game like this. It's like, not this way, dude.
Well, my friend Chris and I would actually double team it. I'd take one paddle, he'd take the other, and we'd go running around and knock out those bad guys. And I guess that wasn't so hard, but oh well.
Chris and I never got along very well, though.
Yeah, so. That's true. You went to different schools together. That was the main reason.
He would never come over play with me, so.
So, Carrington, you had a great topic idea, so I'm going to shamelessly steal it. And I'm going to ask you guys for the host topic. If you had to use a legacy operating system as your daily OS, like the thing that got you by, so they ripped OS X out of your cold, dead hands. They, you know, took Windows and Linux and flushed them down the toilet, and they said, you got to use something that's, I don't know, let me pick it out of the air, 25 years old or more. So which one would it be? And since it was you...
So we're not allowed to say that Windows 10 is a legacy operating system? Okay.
No.
We'll see what the rules are.
Yeah, come on.
So what is this, 1991?
You didn't read the terms and conditions, did you? So, Carrington, since this was your topic, why don't you go first?
Unsurprisingly, I would pick an old version of what I'm on now. If I had to go legacy, like pre-OS 10, and I couldn't just say, well, then I'll stick on OS 10.10 or something. You had to go super old. Then I would be classic Mac. I would find that the only one I'd be able to use because I used it for so many years in my real life. I wouldn't be surprised if there's a point in my future where that becomes my daily driver. Like, I wouldn't bet against the idea. I wouldn't necessarily bet on it, but I wouldn't wager heavily that it would be impossible for the computer era, the desktop, keyboard, mouse, computer era thing, to be a blip in the overall technology. And if everything does eventually move to tablets or voice or whatever, and my main thing I use is like a big a big iPod or something, or a big iPad rather, then maybe like some old OS 10 thing would eventually, I would use a legacy OS as my daily driver. But if I was doing it today, I would probably, see, I never really liked the look of OS 8 and 9 for the Mac, but I would probably pick one of those rather than like System 7 or System 6. Because even though I get preemptive multitasking, which is kind of useless, at least I could technically run more than one thing at once. And I could get on the internet, and I still have a real soft spot for the blocky look of those OSs, and I'm used to them. So I probably would do that, run like a late version of OS 9 on a like a Power Mac G4. And then I could basically, other than the web, you can use most of the internet. I could use Twitter. I could use email. I could use Gopher. I can play a lot of good games. I think I'd be a happy guy. So I'm going to go with that. I'm going to, in my heart, I wish it was System 6, but I would actually select OS 9.
Hmm. And System 6 follows the rules, whereas OS 9 does not.
Oh, how old did we have to go?
Well, if it's 25 years, I think the highest version would be 7. System 7.
Yeah, so... System 7. Okay, then you know what? Then screw System 7. I will pick I will pick System 6.08.
Very specific. 6.08L.
Yes, I'm going to run 6.08. 6.0.8 is what I'm going to run. That's what I will pick. So I'm going to pick it, which is from 1991, 92, something like that. So that's what I'm going to select.
All right, fair enough. And now, as all good hosts do, I'm going to change the rules right in the middle. And I'm going to say that at least one of you guys needs to pick something that's not a GUI. Or,
oh, gosh.
So we got to go further back than this. Paul, why don't you go next?
Well, it has a terminal. I was going to pick Next Up because that's really not changing what I'm doing. Now,
see, I don't think that's
a
fair.
Great cheating answer.
I was thinking the same thing, but I also felt like that was going to be a bit cheating because, you know, that to me, that even more than Classic Mac is the predecessor of Mac OS X. Like, if you took away my Mac and gave me a nicely running Next Step machine today, it would not even faze me. I would do everything just the same. Okay, I'd have a shittier web browser, but like,
exactly.
But that's right. Otherwise, that's about it. Now, like, there wouldn't be a huge difference. So.
Yeah.
I just saw a tweet today where it had Rainbow Apple plus Nextcube equals Silhouette Apple. And that was your retro computer history lesson for the day. And I thought that was really good. But, okay. I don't know.
So you're not sure you're going to allow that?
Okay. I judges? I'm going to think about
Bing.
This.
Are you the judge?
Well, you guys made me host.
However, I am king.
That's true. You're the king. I serve at your pleasure, my liege.
I can't even run a Quadra. So I got pushed seriously old.
Well, that's the thing. That's the weird thing is that, you know, this, I mean, 1991 was System 7 and Next Step, you know? So.
I'm trying to think of, what even. For System 6, it's hard to think. It's hard for me to remember how far back I would have to go for a computer that can run on that. Does it have to be a Mac 2? Do any of the Mac LCs even? I think that's pre-Performa, pre-Quadra, pre... I'm running an SE or something.
I think the LCs would do it.
We were running System 6.
The LC475 definitely wouldn't, because it's my favorite, and it's shipped with 7.1, so there's no way it would run. So maybe the...
SC30?
Maybe the LC3?
Mac LC2s?
But I thought that there was a version 6.08.
Oh, it looks like the LC2. So the LC2, not the 3, but the LC2 will run 6.08.
Right.
Okay.
And a special version for the 2E card.
But then that's okay. So if I'm running 6.08, I can do a 2E card. Yep. Oh, see, you know what? My life would actually be better. I would be improved if I switched to this.
Yeah, I guess all this sort of, it kind of depends on what you're doing, what you're driving daily. But I guess if I could do without the internet, then...
There are days I would really like to.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, K-Pro or something. K-Pro 2. That has a nice, large-ish screen.
Is it? Yeah, there you go.
So is that your final answer?
I'll stick with that. I'll let Jack take Next Step.
Yeah, Jack, what about you? You going for Next Step?
Well, sure. I would say I would go for Next Step, definitely. I mean, it's like I said, it is, you know, people who are used to Mac OS X and have never used an old Next would probably be surprised to see that everything you're doing today has, you know, has a shadow of itself 25 years ago.
Especially if you're a programmer, you're going to recognize a lot of things.
Right. So yeah, I mean, that would be definitely the most comfortable for me. A second, though, if I had to go without a GUI, would just plain old Unix on a terminal, you know, give me a VT320 and I'm all set.
Can I change my answer to Colossus?
So I think I'm going with DOS. Believe it or not.
Oh, yeah. It didn't actually even occur to me.
That never occurred to me either. I guess that would give me some good games.
Yeah, I'm thinking of DOS. I don't remember the exact release date. Does DOS 6.22 come under the wire for my 25 years? I'd have to...
Is that why you picked 25 years?
No. No.
I think that was in about 93 or something.
Oh, okay. Fine.
I could be wrong.
Well, then DOS 5. Because DOS 6 was better, but DOS 4 was horrific. So I'd have to go with DOS 5 then. Because that had some neat new innovations. And as I recall, I think it could use some of the expanded memory stuff. Boy, I'm really scraping some brain cells here. But I know that there are modern day drivers that I could use to get on the internet. I'd only be on the internet in a text mode, but I'd be on the internet. So there you go.
Mm-hmm. 6.22 apparently is June 1994, so just a little too late.
Sorry. Okay. Yeah. What about DOS 5, since you've got that up? Do you have a timeline up?
That'd work. June 91.
Okay.
Yeah, DOS 5 was pretty solid. That was the DOS I used the most when I was sort of forced to use a PC, was in the era of DOS 5. DOS 5 and DOS, also Dr. DOS at the same time. So, but yeah, DOS 5, good choice. Didn't even occur to me either. Never even crossed my mind to pick that.
Is that how you pronounce that? Dr. DOS?
That's how I always pronounce it. I was like, our local people, we'd always call it Dr. DOS.
Yeah, I've actually got a slightly later version of that. It's still shrink-wrapped, in fact. I'm going to let the 80s air out one of these days. But it's after Novell had purchased Digital Research DOS. And so it's actually Novell DR DOS 7, I think, is the version that I have. So, yeah, I'm going to YouTube when I open that up. I'm actually kind of curious to see what's inside that box. So, but that definitely wouldn't count.
It's a mouse.
Yeah, exactly.
Well after that. Yes. Somehow a mouse got in past the shrink wrap.
You're like, this can't use a mouse. What are you doing?
All right. I'm going to move us on. That was a fascinating conversation. That was pretty cool.
You're welcome.
I want to stay on the topic of DOS, though. So, Carrington, tell us about ProDOS.
Mm-hmm. What I should have probably selected, actually. foolish. Oh, yes, of course, if we talk about ProDOS 2.4, then I couldn't pick it because its release date is 2016. So John Brooks has gifted the world something pretty darn swell, an update to ProDOS. So oddly, in 2016, there has been now a released update to ProDOS for the Apple II. Brings a whole bunch of new features. It is crazy that this happened. Jason Scott called this a pure note ringing in the OS space or something like that. Like, so he's excited about it. I'm excited about it. Everyone should be excited about it. Really cool. Has a bunch of nice features and bug fixes. Oddly, for a new OS release, it's smaller and faster than the version that it supersedes. How cool is that? Runs across the board from like the Apple II up, so it actually has more compatibility than ProDOS did previously. I think you still have to run it on a computer with... can't have Integer Basic. I think it's got to have AppleSoft. But other than that, it's like the Apple II's and up. I'm not 100% sure about that, but I think that's the case. And just totally cool and just gives a bunch of new features for the 2GS, like especially when you quit things and how it goes back and like so how it saves its state. And just like a smooth, stable, great bug fix with a bunch of minor and major updates. Released many, many, many years after the last version. So super, super exciting. Way to go, John. Just totally amazing. Everybody should have this. I've got it, and I think it's awesome. And I've never really been a ProDOS person. I think this is going to be the OS that finally gets me on board with ProDOS and learning about it. I have been a DOS 3 user always. I never really jumped on the ProDOS train. It seems a little weird to me. It's a little newfangled. And so maybe I will bring myself to try this new one as my daily driver, as my new answer for my daily driver, ProDOS 2.4.
Yeah, that is wild. And it's interesting because I too have that very same feeling about ProDOS. It's kind of like, it's just a little clunky. I didn't like it. I felt like I was typing all the time, and it's
the typing all the time with the directories. I want to copy this file. Oh wait, I want to copy from /here/that, like naming all the disks and stuff. I'm like, it's too much work.
Right.
But this is an OS that is designed and released in a period where this OS will mostly be used on things like emulators or on computers that have hardware that didn't exist back then, particularly other forms of like solid state disks and run out disk images. And this is an OS that's aware of that and has some features to facilitate that. Like, so how amazing is that? I love that he put this out.
Yeah. Actually the engineering behind this was, quite complicated. He was taking, so the reason it wouldn't boot on the older computers is because it used kind of like a newer version of the 6502. He found those, managed to kind of rewrite it so that it didn't need the new opcodes, made it smaller somehow, and that would have been enough, except then he also added in this like extra quit screen, and various, just a whole bunch of extra sort of utilities that are going to make this much nicer to use. So I have not installed it anywhere yet, but because actually my work, my, daily driver 2E is buried under a pile of stuff right now. But as soon as I unbury it, I'm looking quite forward to setting this up. This is super wild.
It's amazing to me that somebody this late can look at something that like Apple's engineers at the time did and would have done their best at. And he's like, I think by myself I can make this better. it's like Quinn's presentation at Kansas Fest where she's like fixing the beep of the 2C Plus and diving in there. And so, I see, like, because the speed change made this basically impossible to have a right beep. Unless you can just figure out how to make it possible and fix it anyway. And so it's amazing that just individuals can step up nowadays and do things that basically Apple's engineers en masse were, for whatever reason, not able to do at the time. So it's fantastic.
The level of technical sophistication that it would take to do this, the in-depth knowledge that you need in actually a variety of topics, I think it's just about as impressive as it can get. So very cool. A question for you guys on ProDOS and the Apple II language system with Pascal and that, the UCSD. It seems like the ProDOS volume names and file names and that kind of thing feel to me much like the UCSD system. I'm kind of like you, Carrington. I'm a DOS 33 guy when it comes to just, the Apple II in general. But I did heavily use the UCSD P system on the Apple II. And ProDOS, when I've used it, feels kind of like that to me. Do you know if there was any overlap between those things? Was the ProDOS mechanism inspired by the UCSD volume names and that kind of thing? Or
no idea. I never really used the Pascal thing either. I could never, at that back then, I really had a hard time getting my head around the idea that Pascal's a language. Pascal is an operating system. Like, it's a floor wax and a dessert topic. I'm like, topic? What is this thing? And so at the time, I snubbed that then too. So I have very little knowledge. I'm really here more for comic relief.
Okay. Well, we're getting our money's worth. That's for darn sure. But, maybe that's something that I'll poke Dr. Steve and ask him that question, whether or not there was any cross-pollinization there, because it seemed like there was.
They do. There is. So ProDOS came from actually SOS on the Apple III. Like they were working on that on the Apple III, and then whatever happened with the Apple III happened, and they kind of like salvaged part of it to turn it to, because they weren't gonna actually be able to dump the Apple II like they had hoped.
They clearly hoped.
They grabbed some parts of SOS and put it into ProDOS. So actually, SOS disks and ProDOS disks are mutually readable. I mean, they have the same format for everything. Pascal is something else. It has the same number of sectors, but it's some other scheme.
Yeah, no, I didn't think necessarily that they were compatible. I just wondered whether or not the concept of volumes and the file name structures and that kind of thing were borrowed. But now that you mentioned the sauce connection and reusing some of that, that sounds familiar to me, like I'd read that at some point. So very cool. Very cool. All right. Well, I'm going to move on. I actually have something I wanted to throw out here for folks. Kevin Savitz and the Antic team, just in general, they do a bunch of these interviews, and they're great. These interviews are fantastic. One in particular just came out. Mitchell Waite was interviewed. This is an amazing insight into the history of an early author. He wrote books on microcomputer and other technology subjects, but it eventually became microcomputer stuff, computer animation, some language primers, and anyway, I definitely heard his name and the Waite group and was fascinated by this interview. Kevin, by the way, has a really interesting interviewing technique. He asks a question that's like 5 to 10 words in length and manages to get 10,000 word answers from his interview subjects. And if you've ever done any interviewing, you know sometimes it's hard to get people to participate and chime in, but boy, they're jumping right in on these interviews, and it is amazing stuff. So if you're inclined to listen to it, you can get that on the podcast feed. If you'd like to watch it, they do have the Talking Heads version on YouTube, which I thought was really cool. Not the least of which cool thing was actually seeing Mr. Waite's Apple I computer that he built back in the day and still has. So I would heavily recommend all of those interviews, but this one in particular I found really neat.
Wow, that is cool. I definitely am. The Waite group, that's a name that I feel like I know. I had not. There he is. He's holding an Apple I. Wow.
Yeah. And, I mean, I actually have one of their books up in my shelf, the C++ primer. So, anyway, very cool. So go listen to it or watch it or whatever you're going to do. Also, there was another one with Michael, and I don't know how to pronounce his last name. Boucher?
I would have guessed Boucher. I did actually just listen to this like yesterday, and I it didn't stick, but probably Boucher.
Well, and this was MECC, which was an educational thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought this might be worth mentioning just because everybody knows Oregon Trail, and this was one of the guys who kind of did, you know, like debugging work and stuff on Oregon Trail.
Ooh,
so he worked at Mac and talked a little bit about that, and I think he also worked on Odell Lake. So it's short, but it's neat, you know, talking about just sort of what it's like to you know, kind of mostly drop out of school and work on educational software. Does seem a little paradoxical somehow, but
well, that was like when the provost, I think it was, of Harvard was introducing Bill Gates when he was there to give a speech, and he said something like, you know, fantastic accomplishments, but just think what you'd been able to achieve if you'd actually stayed in school and got your degree.
Yeah.
Okay, so let me see. I guess I will mention, since you brought up Oregon Trail, that I actually live at the end of the Oregon Trail, and I didn't die of dysentery when I came here.
Yet.
Operative word. Okay, so let's talk about some other things. Let's talk about Atari for a minute. Jack?
Yeah. So there's an article by Christian Zietz entitled Recovering Atari ST ASIC Designs. And basically what he did was he found a dump of a bunch of files from Atari Corp when it closed down. Started digging these files, and there were some things that caught his eye. He began examining some of the, like, he couldn't actually open up the, like, there were many things were disk images. He couldn't really open them up directly in any programs he had access to. But looking in a hex editor, he found some interesting stuff, and what he realized was that these were diagrams for some of the ASICs in some of the later Atari ST machines. And he describes how he went through the process of using various emulators and pieces of old hardware and stuff to actually unpack these floppies and get them to print out their contents into a PDF format. And it's pretty cool. I mean, not that anyone's going to necessarily build a new Atari ST today using these things, but it's pretty interesting to be able to, it's always good to be able to see the source code, or in this case, the source diagrams for how a piece of hardware is going to be built. So, pretty neat, and he's got a bunch of stuff. You can download things that he's recovered. He hasn't really gone through all of it yet, but he's gone through some of it. So, an interesting historical tidbit.
Well, that is really cool, and I don't know whether it would be useful or not for this, but, you know, there is the MIST and other FPGA implementations of the Atari ST computers, mm-hmm. and if you could get original design work and actually put it into the hardware description language that is used currently to emulate these things, I wonder if that would help you get a more precise emulation. I don't know if it would or not, but, you know, it's an interesting thing to think about.
Yep. Yeah, it seems reasonable. So, yeah, and one of the things he talks about is there are a number of drawings for various versions of Blitter designs. The original ST did not have a Blitter chip at all that came in later. I don't know. I don't remember the timeline. I only ever had one Atari ST, and it was one of the early ones. But at some point, they put a Blitter in there, and apparently that's some of what's in here. And that's probably one of the things that is trickier to emulate correctly. So there's also an incomplete schematic of the Atari Sparrow, which was a Falcon prototype. And he found some other stuff related to something called the Atari Panther, which was a Motorola 68000-based game machine that they never actually released. So
neat.
Anyway, interesting stuff in there, and he seems to have found a system for unpacking some of it, has found, you know, the set of programs needed to make it work. So, pretty cool.
I'm really looking forward to reading this.
So, it's not exactly clear to me. It's from what it seems like, there was a dump of a bunch of, you know, Atari files that then he went, you know, like, that was put online, and then he went and just sort of dug around, tried to figure out what he could find. Like, I see
right.
something in one of these sort of source posts. It was said that someone was given a small collection of PsyQuest 44 meg discs and archived them and made them available. And then someone else came along and kind of like tore them apart. And I think there's a bunch of stuff like that on archive.org, you know, like just mm-hmm. because I know that's one of the things Jason Scott has been doing is just like, you know, archive, you know, like image, dump onto archive.org. And there's still a lot of just sort of archaeology to do. I mean, like
right.
nobody knows what's there.
Yeah.
It's very, you know, it's a kind of like a fun, adventurous thing.
Yep. Yeah. And so like some what he found were, he found some files that were from an old backup format of some kind that he was able to open up this backup file, restore the backup into a new image, and there were a bunch of ARC compressed files with some more of the diagrams and things in them. So it is there's definitely some archaeological sleuthing going on to figure out what there is and how to possibly open this up and find the contents. So pretty cool.
Very cool.
Well, speaking of digital archaeology, apparently we are shaking our digital archaeology like a Polaroid picture.
What?
What do you have to say?
Terrible. Well, I just popped this into our notes because what Jack was saying about, you know, finding the Atari documents, it triggers something that I had read a while ago on Folklore, which I don't think we've talked about. We've talked about the site, folklore.org, which is basically about early Macintosh stuff. But another example of this sort of thing is somebody coming across and discovering Bill Atkinson's Polaroids. So he was an early developer, a brilliant, brilliant guy, basically the fellow behind HyperCard and stuff. So early Macintosh developer. And he had this weird quirk, which ended up saving a lot of interesting historical information, where he kept a Polaroid camera on his desk beside him while he was developing. And when they would hit certain milestones or make an interesting choice or commit to something, he would bring it up on screen, bring up his Polaroid and take a snapshot of the actual computer screen, which is a great way back then to instantly make an archive of something. Like, so like they got the, there's a picture of like the initial Lisa user interface. So it finally compiled, brought it up on screen. He said, oh, look, it's the first Lisa interface. Bang, take a snapshot. Or, hey, we're going to commit to a single button mouse and here's how the iBeam is going to work for cursor selection. Isn't that interesting? Quick, take a snapshot. So there's a great page on folklore.org where you can look at a bunch of these Polaroids, which are through the stages of Macintosh development as they hit different ideas, different milestones. And so these were all pre-beta things, but just as they were working out the ideas that would eventually become the Macintosh operating system. So just what Jack was just talking about, for some reason, reminded me of that. So I thought we should, if you haven't seen it, really worth looking at. And we'll have a link for that in the show notes too.
I'd never seen that before.
Nope, me either. Nice.
Yeah, I was thinking, I don't think we've ever talked about this, but I love this page. It's really, really cool. So.
How, any of you guys look over folklore.org very frequently? I don't know, how often is new content being put on here these days? And I remember when Andy Hertzfeld first started this project, and I was really excited about him going and gathering all these stories and popping them on here, kind of as almost an addendum to the book that he wrote on early Apple Macintosh stuff. But so what about it? Do you guys keep up with this site?
I guess I always thought that it had sort of been, you know, sort of finished a while ago.
yeah?
I don't think there's anything new.
I think so, too. Most of the stuff doesn't seem to be dated. Like, the date will be November 1979, but that's like the date of the thing they're talking about. It's hard to know when they actually posted the items. I think it was mostly dumped over a relatively short time and is now just exists as an archive.
Okay. Well, I guess the good news is that means I can catch up. So.
Yes. Yes, you can. It's well worth looking at. If people haven't, they really should, just to dive in and browse through it. If you're interested in the early Macintosh development, lots of neat behind-the-scenes photos and stories.
All right. Well, and just like there may not be new articles there very often, it sounds like maybe we won't have CFFA 3000s for a while either. What's a deal on that?
Well, the deal is we may not have CFFA 3000s for a while either. that's basically it. unfortunately, okay. So
have we flooded the market?
Well, so I have a feeling that this caught a couple people by surprise, but on Dreher.net, the site of the person who makes the CFFA 3000s, he put a note up mid-August that said, we have not received enough interest to build run number 5 this year. And so he's gotten 115 or so expressions of interest. And so the earliest, I think, that the next run could become available is November 2017. So a year and a bit out from now. So so if you're interested in getting a CFFA 3000, then first, express your interest. And second, prepare to wait. Or, you know, find someone who's selling one for a lot on eBay. So.
Looking at this site, it apparently they've got to do runs of 500 boards. So it makes sense he wants at least 250 commitments. Otherwise, that's a big cash outlay to then just sit on them.
Right. And these, I mean, so they're excellent, excellent things for your Apple II. Among other things, it's a like a flash drive, you know, mass storage device, but it has lots of kind of utilities on its firmware and stuff. It's very useful. A USB thing can plug into it. And so I've been amazed at the fact that he's managed to sell, you know, so many hundreds of these things, and, you know, how big the community must be. But at a certain point, you know, everyone's going to have as many as they need. I think that point isn't now, but apparently only 115 people have told him that they are among those who need one.
They want more, yeah. Because I think most people they're buying their second and third of them.
Right.
So
right.
I've got a couple. I feel bad too bad. Screw those people in the future. But there will be a point in the future where new people come into the hobby. And they'll hear about this great object, and they'll want to get one. But I think Rich can't just keep making them, so it's going to become another thing that was now a retro device that's only available on you know, rare 1 1 exclamation point 1 Steve Jobs
right.
on eBay. So, and who knows what will happen price wise then. So like, I'm really happy that I have a couple of them because they're amazing. But yeah, like eventually all the current hobbyists will have multiple copies and you only need so many.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I do understand that this, I'm sure there's probably some kind of like price shift at doing 500, you know, like it's not feasible to do 250 because then they'd cost twice as much or something. So
not yet, but I think, especially with the maker movement, that fabrication costs for electronic devices are coming down as well. So, you know, more creative ways of making things. And this technology isn't ready for prime time yet, but I saw there was a 3D printer that could print circuit boards. And so for now, that probably wouldn't be feasible, but who knows what it's going to be like 10 years from now.
True,
true. So it'll be 9 years after you can get your CFFA 3000.
Exactly. So, guys, I got to tell you, Christmas came early for me this year. I found out that not only is there going to be another Commodore show joining the yearly lineup, but it's going to actually be in my backyard in Seattle. So,
because none of the rest of us wanted it.
Well, too bad, pal, because it's coming here to the lovely Pacific Northwest. In summer 2017, June actually, there will be a Pacific Northwest version of what is now the Commodore Vegas Expo, or ComVex. The show will be called PAC ComX. It just kind of flows right off the tongue, doesn't it? And it's... sorry about that, Robert. Robert Bernardo is actually, you know, the main... force behind a lot of this, him and his pal, you know, the gang of Commodore enthusiasts that put these on, but man, it needs a better name. It's scheduled to be held at the Living Computer Museum, Yeehaw, in Seattle, Washington. So this is amazing and excellent news for me. And also, do remember, there's a lot of Commodore enthusiasm up here in the Pacific Northwest. We got the Commodore Portland Club. There's a Seattle Club, which is the Puget Sound Commodore folks. There's one that started not too long ago, I think, in Victoria, B.C. So if you put all these things together, or maybe they've been around for a while, actually. So lots of Northwest, you know, us folks up here with our trees and our lattes, we also like our Commodores. So
why were the... all the Commodore people sent to the top left corner. Is it like an Australia thing?
I think it may be. They needed a place to partition us.
So. Why would we give you the good weather? I don't understand.
Rains a lot. Rains a lot. So that's my announcement on that. We'll have a link for that up in the show notes. And to say I'll be going is an understatement. Let me see. What else have we got here? I think we got a couple more things. Carrington, what about this vintage software from Apple?
Well, it's not from Apple. Apple made a purchase, and when the headlines hit the news, at first I thought Apple just bought eBay because it talks about how they've added to their software collection with eBay purchase. I was like, Apple bought eBay?
Well, they could pretty much do that cash, couldn't they?
But it seemed like a really strange thing for Apple to buy. But it turns out, no. What it is somebody at Apple, at One Infinite Loop, made a purchase on eBay. So a fellow who goes by Marco Guy listed a bunch of Apple CDs from the old developer group. I used to get those. So if you were a longtime Apple developer, you would get the CDs all the time with the latest OS releases and just
yes.
stuff. And they're fun to have because they have old QuickTime movies and just neat things on them and neat cover discs and stuff like that. So anyway, somebody at Apple, for some reason, Apple went on eBay and purchased some of these from this fellow. And when he sent them a note asking, why did you do that? They wrote back saying that they were... it was for an internal collection, and there were some discs that were missing from the official Apple archives of this stuff. So I didn't even know there were official Apple archives of this stuff, but turns out there are, and there were some holes in it, and Apple filled those holes by going on eBay and finding the missing discs.
Cool.
So I guess I shouldn't feel bad when I have little missing things in my collection.
No, you should not.
If the great Apple occasionally misses some of this stuff. Wow, that is a really fascinating story.
Totally. So, yeah, so I just thought I'd give a link to a little article about it. And see, so when you find out, always check who, like somebody put in the comments, you want to check who your buyers are because then you can suspend the auction and jack up the price.
They could probably afford it, it's true. But
yeah.
Yeah, huh. It seems pretty un-Apple-like to even care that much about the archives, but...
That's what I thought, too.
At first, when I saw this, I thought, well, yeah, but this is just somebody who works at Apple who likes old stuff, too. But it does seem like he actually did get a response back saying it is actually for Apple's internal collection. Yeah. So I've sold something, I think, to, you know, someone at Apple, and it was kind of like, it was sort of exciting. It's like, oh, okay, I'll send it to Cupertino. But it was for an employee who was interested in the stuff and not Apple itself. So this is the real thing.
Wow. And I guess we need to wish Apple a happy birthday for one of its products.
Mm-hmm.
Is that
yep.
true, Paul?
I believe it's true. the Apple IIgs turned 30, so September 15th, 1986, it was released, and so that's it. The 2C Plus turned 28, but I don't know. I'm not sure that's as momentous, but that was September 16th, 1988. So
it doesn't look a day over 25, honestly.
Yep.
I would also like to point out that I am very old.
Yes, I know.
I remember this as like, you know, I was multiple computers into my computing life before the 2GS came out. I'm like, oh my goodness, and that was 30 years ago? I basically am dust.
Well, they got to keep some of us old-timers around, right? Occasionally we need to sell Apple some of our software collection.
Right.
You know, somebody's got to remember stuff. But there's new stuff. There's new stuff, definitely, so we shouldn't feel bad. Because, you know, we're still interested in the new stuff, right, including the host's retro computing gift idea, which, again, isn't really the host's. It's one of our other esteemed members. So, Jack, if you would like, sir, I'd like to turn the microphone over to you. Basically, I'm now pointing it in your general direction.
All right.
So tell us about the Pocket Chip and why we should all want one, because I know I do.
So the Pocket Chip is a very cool device. We've talked about this a couple times before. Initially, we talked about the chip, which was announced as going to be the first like $9 single board computer or something. And they kind of got leapfrogged by Raspberry Pi on that with the Pi Zero. But it's still a very cool little computer. And what they have come out with this year is the Pocket Chip, which is a little handheld device incorporating the chip computer. The Pocket Chip includes a color display with a touchscreen and a little clicky keyboard, and it's basically running some form of Linux. I'm not exactly sure what it is, and that it includes this Pico 8, which is the software that lets you play and create fun little sprite games. It looks super, super cool. This is sort of like, I think before the iPhone ever appeared, and I was still using Palm devices and things, this is kind of what I imagined. Like, man, I would love to have a handheld device that is running Linux or some kind of Unix and has a nice color screen and can play games and do fun stuff with. And this is it. And so it's a few years later than I wanted to have it, but it seems pretty nice. And it has, there's all kinds of software you can install directly through Apt. It seems quite cool. I have ordered one of these. It is on its way to me. I know a lot of people this week are excited about getting an iPhone 7 heading their way. I don't really care that much about that. I've not ordered one either. But what I have ordered is this, and it's on its way. It got to Belgium 3 days ago. I'm super excited. So I'm watching my package tracking thing a few times a day to see where it is, and it's getting so close.
Excellent. And I don't think we mentioned the cost. How much will one of these set you back?
It is $69 plus shipping. So for what you get, it's actually very, very cool. I mean, imagine having the coolest Game Boy ever that also runs Linux.
And a fully open platform that you can write stuff on.
Well, the fact that it's $70 and you get a 1 gigahertz processor and half a gig of RAM and Wi-Fi and Bluetooth
and
a battery and a screen. I'm like, come on. Like, it's crazy what you get for that cost.
Yep, it is nuts. So I'm super excited about this thing.
Beautiful. And, of course, that'll be in our gift guide. It's probably been in the show notes at some point in the past since we have talked about it. But now it is officially a gift that, you know, if you're inclined, you can buy one for all of us. And I don't think we'd argue at all. Well, except Jack might argue because his is already on the way. But
hey, two is better than one.
That's true.
If you'd like to know what experts are saying about the new Apple IIgs, we'll translate.
It's got a 32-voice sound chip for digital synthesis.
256K on the motherboard with 1 meg expansion.
Hey, check out this RGB color with super high res.
Told ya. 16-bit processor. 2.8 meg clock speed.
The Apple IIgs.
Some machine, huh?
Simply speaking, the most powerful Apple II made.
All right. Let's talk about eBay auctions, other stuff that you can buy. Carrington, even though it goes against my better judgment, I'm going to let you go first.
Dust cover is what I'm selecting. I've actually got three choices of various weirdness. So the first is a vintage Apple dust cover. Is it really from Apple? No, it is not. Is it even... does it even fit any Apple computers? I'm not sure, but it's apparently an old dust cover. It's got a non-Apple but still rainbow stripe little thing on the side. But it was more that I was thinking about dust covers in general when we were trying to come up with host topics. And it occurred to me, like, that's one of the things computers used to have. Like, you would put the dust cover on your computer at the end of the day, and it's just not something we do anymore. And I kind of miss it. I think that would be a neat thing to have, is dust covers for my computers. Not necessarily for, like, I don't want plastic on my sofa and stuff and put those runners down. I don't want to go the full plastic household. But I do think the idea of a dust cover, like back when you'd have to do them over typewriters, I kind of still dig them. So I picked this one because it is $1. Now, maybe there will be multiple bids, I don't know. But if you're looking for a dust cover that might fit some sort of Apple computer, because there's not one in the photo, here's one that is at least relatively cheap. So $1, plus for me, $15 shipping. So not necessarily aimed at Canadians, but a $1 dust cover. So I'm picking that. But I'm also picking a couple other things. One of my favorite eBay resellers is back, kind of comes and goes. It's a fellow from Venezuela, and we would have talked about him years ago, and kind of came on the eBay scene with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of sealed boxes of relatively obscure crappy games, mostly Avalon Hill games. And I and a bunch of other people bought some of them, and they all show up, and they're all legitimate, and they're all totally sealed Apple games that were relatively cheap. I'm going to select The Alien, which right now you get yourself a big box version of a not great game called The Alien, but it's totally sealed. And so for $35, you can get yourself a piece of the 80s shipped free from Venezuela, so free international shipping. I have multiple experience with this seller. I think it's a great seller. If you're looking for a sealed game, you want that release the 80s air experience, there's few ways to get a game from that era still sealed this cheaply. So they're often cassette-based. This is a disc-based game. So there you go. I'm going to select that one. And then my third choice is a weird one. And I don't know enough about these computers to know what's going on here, but there's something strange about this computer. So it's a Coco One, a color computer one, the silver first one, and it's kind of the crappiest of the models because it's model 26-3001, and that means it was like the 4K version, so it's the crappiest, lowest model of the Coco. But something struck me as weird about the photo. I kept looking at it, like, what is weird about this thing? And it's listed as a rare historic one, but just because this person says they went on Wikipedia and it says it's an early computer, and they say it's museum quality, and it's not. It's scuffed up like crazy. Look at this thing. It's like, I don't know what museum this guy goes to, but it's not museum quality. But if you look at it, it has totally the wrong keyboard. What is up with the keyboard on this computer? So the Coco had the chiclet keyboard, like the worst of them, the Coco One, a really flat chiclet keyboard. So at first I thought somebody's taken a later, like a Coco 2 keyboard, because this has the raised ones, the beveled keys. So I thought, well, it's a Coco One with a Coco 2 keyboard, but it's not a Coco 2 keyboard because the space bar should be totally on its own as a fourth row with nothing on the left and right. This has four function keys on the left and right. So what is up with this bizarre keyboard? Probably we have lots of listeners who will say, oh, that's the PAL version of the Coco One or something. I don't know, but it struck me as something very, very weird. I did a Google image search to look at Cocos. I can't find one that looks like this. So this is a Coco One, the crappiest of the models, really scuffed up, but with something funky going on with the keyboard. So maybe there's something weird and rare and collectible here, or maybe it's just a crappy PAL version. I do not know.
Interesting.
Any of you guys know what's up with this keyboard?
I do not.
Nope.
Yeah.
No.
I also do not, but I see what you mean. I mean, yeah. I've been digging around image searches as you've been talking, and
Yeah, because it kept striking me as like, what's weird? And then I realized, oh, it's raised keys. And then I realized, wait, no, it's not just raised keys. It's a totally wrong keyboard. It doesn't match any of the Cocos.
And one of the photos shows that it has a keyboard overlay for one of the pieces of software. It looks like the keyboard overlay is meant for the normal chiclet keyboard to like fit over that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Anyway, really strange. It comes with a disk drive, which is kind of neat because you don't get those with Cocos much. And right now it's $49 with no bids. So it has a buy it now of $600, which I think this person put just because they think from Wikipedia it looks like a rare computer. For all I know, it's a crazy super rare computer. It's actually worth $600. But maybe it's a total steal for $49. I don't know. 3 days left. I don't understand it, but I think there might be something funky and collectible here. Huh. So that's my third choice.
All right. So I'll try to keep the thing from being posted for the next 3 days. I was going to say about the dust cover that at first when I saw that, I thought, all right, well, maybe that's just a Spectrum. But it's not a Spectrum either. Oh. It looks a little bit, it has a kind of a Spectrum-esque quality, but it has too many colors for a Spectrum, and the colors are in the wrong order for Apple.
I think it's probably a typewriter keyboard from the 80s with a rainbow stripe.
Yeah, it probably is.
Or a typewriter or dust cover, but whatever. It's a dust cover. I like it.
Yeah, it's just it's 80s, you know, 80s stuff.
And it's a dollar. There's another really nice dust cover at the moment on eBay that's for the Atari 400, and it's all embroidered. It's a custom, like a person newly makes them and embroiders Atari 400 or whatever you'd like on them. And that's but it's like $18. That's way too expensive. I'm picking the dollar one.
I think dust covers, you know, especially for retro collectors that keep your computers out, I think those do really have a purpose. I had a couple of VT100 terminals, but I only had one keyboard. So I bought a keyboard online from this guy who was selling a few of them. So I got the keyboard, I get it, and a couple of the keys don't work. So I email him and say, hey, you know, I got this problem. He says, okay, here's what you do. Turn the keyboard over and firmly but carefully bang on all of the keys.
Drop 3 inches.
I'm like, okay. You know, that's a new technique. Hadn't tried that one before. Did it. Plugged the keyboard back in. Worked like a charm. So I'm thinking, you know, some dust and whatever had snuck in there over time, and that knocked it out. But it'd be better to have the dust not get in there in the first place, right? So especially for, like, monitors that love to collect up dust and also the keyboards, it'd be great to have these dust covers. But how do you get them fitted for the equipment that you've got?
Most, you can get them custom made, and even on eBay, most vintage computers have people that make like new ones. You can get like a custom made leather like dust cover for your 2GS, that sort of thing. So they also keep the sun off, so that might be a nice thing to stop discoloration.
Yes. Mm. Cool. Well, nice picks. All right, Jack, I thought you had a typo on your pick, but then I went to it and realized perfectly correct. So
it is not a typo. Something I thought was a typo. So often I go on eBay and I search for Atari, and I found that someone was selling a game. So there was a popular Atari 2600 game called Grand Prix, written by David Crane, the famous developer who went and started Activision. And, you know, it was a fun, great game. And this is a Taiwanese ripoff of the game called Grand Prix. So Grand becomes Grammed, and Pre, which was PRIX, becomes Prix, PRIKS. And it has an incredible piece of artwork that looks like, I don't know, some sort of devilish motorcycle driver and a lady wearing a prom dress and the weird explosions. I don't know what's going on.
Best prom ever.
And I searched around and I found that apparently the same, I don't know if it's the same, but maybe the same or a similar Taiwanese company did other things. Like, for instance, the game Phoenix was released as Fireberg, which is close to Firebird. What else did I find? A Flash Gordon game became released as Sparker Garden. Lots of crazy stuff that happened in the 80s. So if you want to buy your Grand Prix for the Atari 2600, there are currently no offers. It's got 29 days left. The buy it now price is 4,500 euros. Somehow I think that it's going to end up going for less than that. So pretty crazy. I might bid $1 to see.
I mean, but think about it, Jack. Where else can you get this?
It's hard to find a good copy of Grammed Pricks.
It really
the ROM
is.
The ROM is freely available online and can be downloaded. So if you want to play the game, you can.
Yes.
So this is just about the cartridge.
It's just about
that's
the cartridge.
Very
it's, just,
expensive.
It's that artwork. I'm after the artwork.
I would like a poster, I will admit.
For the collector who has everything. Yeah. Okay. Yep. Nice find. Yeah, I think, you know, I might pass on this one. I mean, it's pretty tempting.
Does it come with a dust cover?
All right, Paul. What have you got for us?
So last time I had very few, so I made up for that by putting a huge number in our show notes. I don't know. Again, I will say I'm not sure I'll get to all of them. But the first one I have here is if you wanted to get a data set, you know, a Commodore VIC-20 data set, new in its box, there is a seller in, I don't know where they are, Manchester, that seems to have just tons of them, except there are only three available. So I thought this was the picture, the auction picture is kind of funny.
Oh, there's two available now.
Uh-oh, really?
Mm-hmm. 264 sold, two available.
Interesting. Okay, my screen still says 363, so hurry up, everyone, if you want one of these. 25 British pounds, buy it now, and about 9 to ship to here, at least internationally. So, anyway, the auction picture is kind of funny just because it's just sort of like, you know, just crates of data sets as you would have bought them back in the day. So
I wonder, you know, with a lot of the tape recorder-based storage devices, you have problems with some of the pieces in there, like either belts or the roller. Mm-hmm. The rubber kind of decomposes. Does that happen because of use or because the thing's sitting out? Or would that still happen, I wonder, if they're sitting in a box in the warehouse?
I would bet it happens anyway. That's what I've heard.
Mm-hmm.
It's just time and air. Well, so maybe these are boxed up, you know, and there's less, you know, air moving around. I don't know.
I guess less air movement.
Contained, you know, they're holding on to that 80s air again. But then, I don't know.
And these are the...
My people sustain themselves by breathing that.
So these are apparently new in the box. If, you know, if you're one of the lucky persons who gets the last two... here, but this was a really fascinating find. And yeah, it's kind of fun to see the boxes of them. Remember, it reminds me of the old retail days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am kind of amazed, though, I mean, how many there were and how close they are to gone. there were apparently 266 were available and 264 are gone, so interesting. Okay, the next thing is a robot arm. Which I thought was just kind of interesting. It's an arm. I'm not sure exactly how many degrees of freedom. It has a at least a joint in the middle and a hand that can swivel and close. I know you can connect these up to computers because I have a couple of these, but I don't have this box. So you can, one way that you can run them is to plug a Atari joystick into it, and then you can. And you can sort of control it in that way. But you also, I think I have a couple of cards that go on the Apple II that can communicate with this as well, through a little box in between. And so they're very, you know, robot arm looking. They're pretty big, actually, too.
It looks like this one connects to an MSX.
Oh, does it? This same seller has a couple of them. And I know that one of them said they connect to the MSX, and maybe this one does as well. I thought this was actually just the arm with no interface. But anyway, yes. So if you have an MSX machine, you could use this, or if you have an Atari joystick, you could use it just for fun, I guess, to drive it around. They're kind of cool looking. It's kind of expensive, though. This is a $75 buy it now, shipping from Saudi Arabia.
I did see when looking at this one that in the also viewed list below, someone has the same thing without the box, but with two Atari joysticks all ready to go for the same price.
Ah. Uh-huh. Yes, okay, so you can shop around. It has little feet, too, that help anchor it when you're trying to pick up heavy objects with your robot arm. The bass, I can't quite see it from here, but it's somewhere. But the bass is pretty heavy. So it should be able to pick things up relatively well. Anyway, okay. Another thing that came up was a QX16. So we've talked a few times about the Epson QX10, which is a CPM machine. And the QX16 came after it and included actually also PC compatibility, sort of like built in. So it's kind of like a dual CPM PC machine.
It was meh compatibility. It wasn't great. Yeah, it wasn't fantastic.
Ah, okay. I've always been kind of curious about it. I like the QX10 more because that's the one that I actually used in my past. But this is kind of neat. It has the actual Epson monitor, and it has the machine and the keyboard. I guess it doesn't say. I don't see a picture of the keyboard actually. You want it to have the keyboard because there are special keyboards for this. But nope. Nope, no monitor or keyboard. So maybe this is just fun for looking at the pictures. These don't come up very often, actually. I don't think they sold very many of them. The QX10 actually had a card. I'm forgetting now who made it. Titan, I think. Actually, the QXPC that would do PC compatibility on the QX10 as well.
So, wow, that's waking up some old brain cells. I remember that card.
Do you think that worked any better than the QX16?
I don't recall. It was too niche. I mean, I think I only encountered one or two of them.
Mm-hmm. I have two, unbelievably. But I haven't I guess they must have been, yeah. But I haven't actually tried it out yet. That's, I have a very long list of things to try out. But I was pretty pleased to see that, like in a QX10 I got at one point, there was one in it. So, okay, this is a weird thing. I thought it was a weird thing. I never heard of such a thing. It is a Pencil 2, a Hanamex Pencil 2 computer. I don't even know what it looks like. I kind of like the style of it though. It's kind of blue and gray, and it has orange, sort of like, character highlights on the keys. And it is starting bid at $300, buy it now of $650. And it's coming from Cairo. So they believe it's something special. I had never heard of this before. I did look up a little bit about it, and it was an Australian computer that had ColecoVision support, so you could actually plug a ColecoVision cartridge in it and play that. But
interesting.
Anyway,
I wonder if that means that this is in some way compatible with or related to the Atom, since that was also a ColecoVision based thing from Coleco.
Yeah, I wonder. It says built and conceived in Hong Kong by Soundic Electronics, has a Z80 chip in it. And a Coleco adapter, but my guess is that it is not at all related to Coleco.
Right. Interesting. I think the design of it is actually quite striking. It's a really nice-looking thing, despite the chiclet keys. Like, they're actually very nice-looking chiclet keys. I love the colorful keycaps and things.
Yeah, and the blue looks very pleasing as well. So take a look at the pictures.
It would be nice if they had hooked up to a TV and we could see what actually... what it does, but no such luck.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of sites out there. Once I actually started looking for the Pencil 2, found a couple of photos out there, including there's a WordPress site called pencil2computer.wordpress.com, and it has a big thing. It says, Hanamex Pencil 2 home computer, welcome. I will be dedicating this site to the Soundic Hanamex Pencil 2 computer. But then that's actually all that's on the site from April 2015. So at some point, Have 5000 will possibly dedicate a site to the Pencil 2 computer. But at this point, it's just a landing page. So something to look forward to.
The picture of the box has a picture on the back showing a photo of the device with a bunch of expansion things stuck onto the side. So kind of like
oh, nice.
TI-994A style, build your computer system out by sticking things on to the right.
I would kind of like to have this. I'm not going to bid on it, but if it's neat.
Yep.
And it's always kind of neat to like come across some computer you've never even heard of before.
Right.
So I assume neither of the other two of you have heard of it.
Never heard of it.
I always like computers named two. Those are that's kind of nice.
Right.
But let's see. I guess what else to say? There is a...
I had a pencil 2B.
So I guess maybe the other thing I will mention here is there's a Spectrovision 328, another computer I really hadn't heard of. Doesn't look as pretty. It's kind of weird looking. It's like it's a little. It's kind of like a tray of keys.
Which was their first slogan. Didn't really take off.
Yeah, and it has a weird shaped stop key kind of up in the upper center. But yeah, so this is another computer I know very little about. 1983 Spectre Video 8-bit home computer.
Really pushes the size of their ROM for some reason.
Yeah. Yeah, as I say, I don't know very much about this. I managed to bring up a Wikipedia page about it. But another computer I don't think I'd heard of before, even though I probably should have. Spectre Video sounds familiar, but anyway, is this old news to any of you?
No, I've not heard of this either.
Nope.
One thing
it has 80K of RAM and 32K of ROM. I'm just thinking
yeah.
past that. It's awesome.
Yeah. It seems like it's more important to them to have the 32K of ROM.
It's more ROM than you'd ever need, really.
Yeah.
All that ROM. I noticed in the description that it's saying that this is coming from a museum that's being closed and all items are for sale. So
I know their name. They made games. They made Atari 2600 and VIC-20 games, Spectre Video. I knew
right.
I'd seen them before. That's why. Okay.
Uh-huh. Good catch, though. And looking at the other things the seller has, there's some other stuff I had put on my own watch list. There's a Panasonic PC, probably JR200U with cassette deck that I thought was kind of cool, if you look through the other listings. And
yeah, and a bunch of Heathkit things, so yeah. They've got neat listings. It's sad that a museum would close, though, and dump all their stuff on eBay.
Yeah. Oh, well. Anyway.
I still think you should talk about your other choice, too. The
memory disk?
Memory disk.
Okay.
Because it confused the heck out of me what it was at first.
Yeah, well, that was actually the main reason I was going to talk about it. It was that there's a thing, it says Mac memory disk, and it was sold, I think, by Assimilation, which looks like, the logo makes it look like it's the same people as Assimilation Process, who made little like trackballs and stuff. So it's a sealed package. It is a little 3.5-inch disk. It says 10 times faster, make your 512K Mac run 10 times faster. And I looked at this and I thought, oh, that's, you know, I thought what it was a 3.5-inch floppy shaped RAM disk. Like
that's what I thought too.
Like actually it had RAM in it, but it was in the shape of a floppy and it would emulate a floppy and you'd put it in your drive and it sounded fantastic. Actually what it is a virtual memory program. So it's basically just this is the way you deliver software back in those days. You deliver it on a disk, you install it, and then you don't need this disk anymore. But so it seemed like the idea seemed very cool, and the program itself probably is just fine. I saw a couple of reviews of it in InfoWorld or whatever, but yeah, it's a little less exciting than it initially seemed. So I thought I would end on a downer.
Well, I too got really excited about it because I never heard of this thing before until I saw your listing, and I'm reading about this how it's a RAM disk, and I'm like, does it come with batteries? Like, how does this power itself? And I was thinking, like, this is the most amazing idea to have a 3.5-inch floppy that's actually a RAM disk that I guess can be read somehow by the floppy head. Like, I'm like, this is amazing. Like, how did I not know about this thing? So I built it up in my mind to be this incredible thing. And so while you were talking, I went online and I found a review of it from Macworld magazine, and I read it. I'm like, oh, this is highly disappointing.
Yep.
So yeah, it's actually just a piece of software. And I guess you do have to keep the how it works is it's like a system that doesn't even have a system disk on the floppy, so you can install this and then have a minimal system on a floppy with another app, but it's using a system that's now kept in RAM. So if you have enough memory to make your 512 pretend it only has like 128K, you can swap out the same. Anyway, bad idea, probably poorly implemented, but at first looked really exciting.
Yep. And actually, I don't even know if I'm going to keep this in, but when I was searching around, I actually found the author of it has a web presence. And that's a weird trail to follow. I think I will just maybe leave it there. But he believes the world owes him deeply.
We probably do.
Yes, it's
because of Mac Memory Disk.
No. It's quite an interesting mind that has produced this. And
maybe
then,
because he kept part of his mind in a RAM disk.
Right, in a brownout.
And, right. It was destroyed. I was always afraid of RAM disks.
Yeah.
Still kind of am, actually.
But, yeah, I don't think I'll put the link in there, but there's a he does have a site of his sort of current pro se litigations underway, and it's all in like 9-point font.
Well, I hope we in the future have him on as a guest on the RCR.
Yep.
I look forward to that.
Okay.
And we, remember, we have picked both a hobby and, a technology world full of eclectic people. So
that's true.
This is true.
That's true.
All right. Well, we've almost spent all our money, but I'm going to try and get us to spend a little more. I found an Apple III on eBay, and it works. And apparently the person who owns it currently has adjusted the floppy disk, and luckily I have an Apple III expert with us on the podcast who can confirm this, but I think the floppy disk is one of the things that is a frequent headache on the Apple III, right, Paul?
Yeah, well, they do often require adjustment, like speed adjustments and stuff. I have had pretty good luck with mine, but Mike has not had pretty good luck with his, so does need to be done from time to time. And it sounds like this one actually does work.
Yeah.
Without adjusting.
It shows that it was booted up in sauce. And, I'm looking at some of these pictures, and it's got some wear and tear like you would expect of a machine of this age. But overall, it looks in pretty stinking nice shape. And mm-hmm. The fact that it boots and works, he says that there's an issue with the keyboard from time to time where you'll get the keyboard runaway, and I'm wondering if that's just a stuck key. But anyway, so I thought that this was a really good deal at $200 for a starting bid. And if you want to jump right on it, you can for $450. That may be a little on the high side. Again, Paul, check me on that, but I didn't think the opening price was that out of whack for an Apple III that works and is in this nice shape.
Yeah, no, that sounds fairly reasonable. I think $450 is probably a little much. The prices on these fluctuate all over the place. So I think I have gotten a bunch of them for less than this, individually, but after a lot of waiting and pouncing at the moment it's listed and that kind of stuff. What do I have to say about this? I guess it doesn't have any cards in it. One of the screens is booted up to something that says Titan 3 plus 2E machine startup main menu, which is like a pre-boot disk that you use for a card that will kind of emulate a 2E in your Apple III. And that card is not here. That card is desirable, but the card is not here. So he booted it on that, but it is not included. But otherwise, yeah, a lot of these have cracks in the cases and things, and this looks like it's in pretty good shape. There's a couple little like grooves, but it's shown to be working, so that's puts it way ahead of a lot of them.
Puts it ahead of me.
Yeah, right.
Hey, how's the progress been on that ready to run Apple III emulator that you guys talk about from time to time?
I don't think there's been much that's happened on it recently. There are a couple of updates here and there in the emulator that it uses, the MES emulator. But I don't think Egan Ford was the one who put that together, and I don't think he has made any recent updates to that. But it works. It works just fine. I actually used his ready-to-run image to format a like a CF card to use in an actual Apple III, which worked quite nicely. So that was cool. Pretty handy.
Yeah. Does it run the language products like the COBOL and the Pascal and stuff like that?
I think he has some of those on there. I'm not sure if he has all of them, but I'm pretty sure he did put COBOL and Pascal on and Business Basic.
Nice.
So, yep.
All right. Well, it's time to go around the table. So, Carrington, anything on your side? Mm-hmm. No? Okay. Paul?
Well, I want to give a quick link to something that wasn't really tech-related, so I didn't throw it in the main links, but I think our listeners might be interested in it. Fellow did a teardown, same product, 50 years apart. What product? Hair clipper. So a company has a patent from, I don't know, 100 million years ago, from 1958 for an electric hair clipper. And his dad was in the army, got to keep your hair really short, so he bought this hair clipper and has had that same trimmer for ages and finally handed it down to his son. His son went and needed a new one and got, it turns out that exact model is still sold, the Wahl, WAHL, still in the existing brand. You can still buy that Wahl hair clipper.
Really?
Looks 90% the same from the outside. So he bought a new one and said, won't it be interesting to tear it down and see what has changed? Same product manufactured by the same people for more than 50 years. So he just opened them up and said, like, let's see how a simple but working design gets slightly changed over half a century. Really, really interesting to see how little has changed and what tiny tweaks were made and to try to deduce for what reason. So for people interested in retro goodies, I thought they would enjoy this site. So I'll have a link to that. And you can see the teardown, same product, 50 years apart.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
It's interesting, considering we're always talking about companies who are always trying to innovate and come up with new things all the time in this industry. And here is somebody who is making the same thing for 50 years, just minor tweaks.
Yep, and still works.
Still goes.
Still make it, sell it for a profit. There you go. And even in this site, he talks about how most things we deal with, most tools, are kind of divided into electronic tools that get changed all the time, and then non-electric ones. Like if you have a 200-year-old hammer, it'll still work for a screwdriver as long as it's still fine. And this weirdly bridges the gap because it plugs in, it has moving parts, it's electric, but has been unchanged for more than half a century. And still is an existing product you can buy today. So it's just neat. It tickled me.
Cool.
So I thought we'd throw that link in too.
Yeah, very cool. Do they have a video on that or is it just pictures?
No, just lots of pictures though.
Pictures.
Lots of pictures to show you the two different products torn apart and so you can look at the insides and it goes into the details of like what are the really minor changes and what changed in what part of it and where and probably why.
Nice find, Carrington.
Yeah.
What about you, Jack? Anything parting shots here?
Well, while we were talking, I did go and bid €1 for Grammed Bricks, so I'm keeping my fingers crossed.
I hope you get it. If you get it, scan it. I want that as a T-shirt.
Definitely.
What would be hilarious is if you're the only one who bids.
Yeah. 29 days, one bid.
Well, good luck.
Thank you.
All right. What about you, Paul?
Well, for some reason, I have a number of TV notes I wanted to make, but I also noticed, I'm never sure if it's just me or what, but it seems like as of about like 2 weeks ago, eBay has lifted their 200 cap on the watch lists. So at least I am capable of putting many more things on my watch lists now. So,
unsurprisingly, I did not know there was such a cap.
Yeah.
Because what sane person would ever hit that?
But oh, okay. Yeah, it's a... It's like when your hard drive fills up. It's like this little juggling act. Well, do I care? Am I gonna care what this sells for? No. Okay, I'm not gonna buy that. And you know, so I always have to keep like sort of filtering things out to add the new things in. But now I no longer have to do that. So that's good.
I just checked eBay. I have two items on my watch list, both of which have ended.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I think I'm probably.
And you know what? Don't even care. Oh, look, they've both been relisted. Eh,
yeah.
Can't be bothered.
So I'm probably at somewhere like 233 or something now. And,
oh, my goodness.
But,
so many.
Yes. Also, I saw a couple of different places. Commodore 64 is on TV. So just made an appearance on Mr. Robot. And of course, Halt and Catch Fire has these all over the place. So that's kind of cool.
Hooray for Mr. Robot. I'm digging it.
I don't understand it, but I'm watching it.
I was going to say, speaking of that, though, also I just noticed on the TV show Preacher, I think based on a comic book, the evil bad guy is also, he's got a Counter 64 at his desk. I think he's playing Boulder Dash or something at some point.
Nice.
That lets you know he's the evil bad guy.
Cool. Well, that will be the thing that tips me over into watching it, I'm sure.
There you go.
But So another thing that came to my attention is that Darrow O'Brien, who some people may know from British television, he's host of Mock the Week, and I think he used to be a physicist, and he's kind of a comedian now. But he has a show on Dave called Darrow O'Brien's Go 8-Bit. Where
oh, fantastic! And he's great. I love him.
Yeah. No, he's. I find him very funny, actually. So he's got. He's basically got guests on. You know, basically, you know, like the British panel show people, generally coming on and playing video games while they talk about them. You know, they. I think they pick a game and then each of them picks their favorite game and they play against each other and it's, you know, so they're basically from Pong to Nintendo, maybe, or so, or, you know, like that kind of range. But I can't decide if I like it exactly, but it's kind of neat that it's on TV, you know.
I think this show is highly relevant to my interests.
Yep. So check it out if you have some way to watch shows on Dave.
Yes, I have been on the internet.
Yes, exactly. And I guess the last thing, just to mention, way back at the beginning, Earl mentioned that we were almost, episode 137 was almost Leet, 1337. And I wanted to point out, if people didn't already know it, that the IT Crowd has subtitles in Leet for the first episode. So, and they're hilarious.
I have got to go back and watch that again now.
Yeah, they're fantastic, fantastic subtitles, too.
Oh, man. I have to admit, I really love that show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so did you guys, is this the first you're hearing of that, of the subtitles? Because they really are. Yeah,
didn't know about that. That is great.
You will appreciate them. Anyone who hasn't seen them, I think probably who's listening to this will appreciate them, because they're just various levels of nerddom in there. So, like, you'll get all of the references. Someone really knew what they were doing when they put them in. But I think, I'm trying to remember the subtitle for... you know, I don't know anything about computers, one of them says at one point, and it says, you know, the subtitle is, I use Macs. And there's another one where it's like, oh, I should just pack up all my stuff and go home. And it's like, you know, the subtitle is like tar CVF. CD tilde. It's very nice.
Fantastic.
So the tricky part is going to be finding IT Crowd on DVD, because I usually watch it on Netflix. So I'm going to have to see if they have it at the library. They have a lot of the British shows at the library, actually. So,
well, that's the kind of thing when you could get there's a box set. You can either get the seasons 1 through 3 or the full thing with the abbreviated fourth season on eBay. Pick it up used. I bet you could pick up the box set really cheap.
Oh, take a look at that, too. That's a good idea.
That's where I would look for it.
Nice.
Yeah, so I haven't actually followed this up to figure out where you can get these. But yes, I know they exist, and they're hilarious. So, good luck. If I find out, I'll post a link in the show notes.
So, good luck.
Nice. All right. Well, yeah, I guess I'll close this out. I built a Wi-Fi controllable little robot, little tricycle robot that runs around the house. And I built it with a very cheap brain, which I think is the most interesting thing here.
Because that works so well for Frankenstein.
Yeah, it did. So I've talked, I think, before about the ESP8266. It's a microcontroller. It has Wi-Fi built in. You can get ones that have lots of general-purpose I/O pins and all that, and even a little USB port for programming for like $3.50 shipped on eBay. So, and you can program it using the Arduino IDE, which is fun. So... and it's got this huge library of routines built in, including a whole bunch of Wi-Fi stuff. So the little thing actually runs a web server. You surf to it from your computer, your smartphone, or whatever. And this little robot thing, you click left, and it goes left. And I got some lag. I need to figure out how to talk to it with sockets rather than trying to use full-blown web pages, because that's just kind of slow. But I thought... how fun that you can pay $3.50 for the brains of this thing, $10 for a motor controller that's got the transistors with oomph that can actually drive the motors. You know, it's not very much money that you put into this stuff, and you can do really cool stuff. I'm so digging this maker movement. Anyway, so that's what I've been doing the last week or two, you know, just trying to hack out this code and, you know.
That is seriously awesome. Do you have links for the components you've used so you could share with the crowd?
I don't, but I can. Why don't I do so? That's a very...
I would like those links.
It's a very, very good suggestion.
By the crowd, I mean, just show me what you bought. I am
interested. Yeah. One of them is the OS EPP motor driver. I'll have a link for that because you can buy that from a bunch of different retailers. The $3.50 card, you know, the Wi-Fi microcontroller that I bought, you can find those scattered all over eBay, but there's a couple pages where they explain what they are in that, so I'll dig up those links and use those.
Kansas Fest needs to drop Bite the Bag and bring on BattleBots.
Ooh. Oh my gosh, wouldn't that be fun? I just finished watching the latest season of BattleBots and love those giant robots, you know, yeah, ripping each other to shreds. So,
I think Dar O'Brien also hosts Robot Wars, which is a similar kind of thing. But
I've seen those. Yeah, those are good. Yeah, you can find.
In fact, Robot Wars was the one I had in my head. And even though I said BattleBots because it was the first name I could remember. But yes, awesome.
All right, so go Dar O'Brien.
Yeah, very nice.
Maybe we can have him on the show.
All of our interests. Hey, it never hurts to ask. I didn't know that we'd get Ben Heck on the show, but, you know, that happened. So. Yeah,
and who was the guy who used to do Robot Wars from Red Dwarf?
There's a new Red Dwarf out, too. Red Dwarf just started again.
I'm so excited about Red Dwarf. Bring on the Red Dwarf.
They're doing another series of that?
Yep.
Oh. All right.
Red Dwarf 11.
My TV queue is too loaded up.
Make room.
So that, I'm going to say that you can find the show notes for all RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. I'm saying it because it's true. You really can. You can discuss us in the forums over at vcfed.org. We'll have a link in the show notes. It's a new home, but the same forums. It's part of the Vintage Computer Federation. I think that in French is Federation Computer du Vintage. I just totally Perfect. Made that up. Sorry.
Sounds legit.
Yeah. Carrington, you're Canadian. Was that right?
No. No. All of our listeners in Quebec are what?
You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group by searching for Retro Computing Roundtable. You'll find us, I guarantee it. You can send feedback, including hate mail from my terrible French, at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network, so if you don't like us, you can just throw us back. There's a Facebook group for that, too, and you can find it at throwbacknetwork.net. If you do like us, though, and don't want to throw us back, then writing a review on iTunes helps other people find us, and it also inflates our already ginormous egos. And with having said all that, before I get myself in more trouble, until next time,
Retro Compute!